I'm delighted to introduce Sinead Morrissey, who probably doesn't need much introduction for many of you. She's an immensely distinguished poet. I will just do a short introduction. I'll introduce her, and then she's going to read her poems for about a quarter of an hour, and then we'll have a conversation for maybe 20, 25 minutes, and then she'll read more poems at the end. So, Sinead was born in 1972 in Portadown, Armagh, in Northern Ireland, spent much of her childhood in Belfast. Her father was born a Catholic and her English mother had an Anglican background, but she had no religious leanings. They met at a Communist Party meeting and had no religious leanings, for which Morrissey is deeply thankful. She said, "We had the most extraordinary upbringing in which they had conversations about everything, and we didn't have the upbringing that most people in Northern Ireland had, and I'm very grateful to my parents for that, for giving us a different perspective." In other words, they didn't keep talking about the Troubles. She went to Trinity College Dublin and took a BA and a PhD there. Travel's been very much part of her life. She lived in Japan and New Zealand before coming back to Belfast, where she was appointed writer in residence and then reader in creative writing at Queen's University. In 2016, she was appointed professor of creative writing at the University of Newcastle, where she now lives with her husband and two children. She started writing poetry early and has published altogether 6 collections of poetry. She confessed to me earlier, perhaps I shouldn't say this, that she doesn't like her first collection. But the first was There Was a Fire in Vancouver, 1996. Between Here and There was 2002. The State of the Prisons, 2005. Through the Square Window, 2009. Parallax, 2013, and On Balance, 2017. The list of prizes she's won is astonishing. The Forward Prize, the T.S. Eliot Prize, the John Llewellyn Rees Memorial Prize, the Eric Gregory Award, the Patrick Kavanagh Award, and this is just to name but a few. Tonight she's going to be reading from her latest collection, which is called On Balance, which has already won the Forward Poetry Prize for Best Collection, and it is formidable. Its themes are equilibrium, balance, our ecological and economic fragility, and in poems ranging from global warming to gender equality. Her longer poems and sequences, where she writes about the great feats of engineering throughout her history, the Titanic, Brooklyn Bridge, the building of aeroplanes, are dauntingly impressive for me, but just as memorable are her framings and images, including history and memoir too, her grandparents, parents, and children. So I'd like to welcome her and to ask her to come and read. Welcome, Sinead.
Thank you very much, Esther. As Ursula said, I'm going to read from On Balance. And the first poem in this collection is called The Miller Helen. And Miller Helen is a fanciful unit of measurement, I think made up by a wit on Radio 4. And if Helen is the face that launched 1,000 ships, a Miller Helen is the amount of physical beauty required to launch a single ship. And I go back to 1911 in Belfast, when the launch of the shell of the Titanic, before it was kitted out and finished, took 62 seconds and went off without a hitch. It was a ticketed event for charity. The Miller Helen. It never looks warm or properly daytime in black and white photographs. The sheer cliff face of the ship still enveloped in its scaffolding, backside against the launching cradle. ladies lining the quay in their layered drapery, touching their gloves to their lips, and just as they that go down to the sea in ships rises from choir boys' mouths in wisps and snatches, and evil skitters off and looks askance for now. A switch is flicked at a distance, and the moment swollen with catgut about to snap, with ice picks, hawk's wings, pine needles, eggshells, bursts, and it starts. Grandstand of iron, palace of rivets, starts moving, starts slippery sliding down, slow as a snail at first in its viscous passage, taking on slither and speed, gathering in the atlas-capable weight of its own momentum, tonnage of grease beneath to get it waterborne, tallow, soft soap, train oil, a rendered whale, this last, the only Milla Helen, her beauty slathered all over the slipway. Faster than a boy with a ticket in his pocket might run alongside it, the bright sheet of the lock advancing faster than a tram. Heavy chains and anchors kicking in lest it outdoes itself, straining up to a riot of squeals and sparks, lest it capsizes before its beginning, lest it drenches the aldermen. And the ship sits back in the sea as though it were ordinary and wobbles ever so slightly. And then it and the sun-splash tilted hills, the railings, the pinstriped awning, in fact, everything regains its equilibrium. We feel a particular kind of ownership in Northern Ireland over the invention of the radio, because Marconi sent a signal from Rathlin, which is the largest offshore island, to Ballycastle. And a colleague of mine at Queen's told me that Marconi had turned on, not on that particular occasion, but before, he had turned on his receiver, he did not turn on the transmitter, so he turned on the receiver, and without the transmitter being active, apparently this receiver filled with voices, and Marconi was convinced that these were the voices of the dead. This is exploring that idea, really. It's called Receiving the Dead, and in it I imagine Sherlock Holmes addressing Dr. Watson, just for fun, but also because Arthur Conan Doyle was such a convinced spiritualist. It's in three short parts. Receiving the Dead. Elementary, Watson, that the dead are legion, eager to speak and awaiting a wireless telegraph system to usher them in. That the pain of aeons is galvanizing. Bats chittering inside a cave's auditorium, or a thousand starlings amplifying evening over the sodden docks, that sounds like this might issue forth as soon as he flicks the switch should not be shocking. Receiver without transmitter, plugging itself into the disturbed nest of the afterworld where everyone's still at home. This amber lacquered box contains within its frame the fits and shredded ectoplasm of our own dear century in a 20th century form, and bids all the dead welcome. Listen. A choir of fire. You are being watched, my little Friedel. The door jammed and undulating, the discarnate jostling for position at the microphone. Tell Daddy I'm... The keys in your blue coat pocket, Salah. Can't you remember? Giggles ascending their scales, then stopping, weeping, warnings. A war is singing. All she gets from the Iceman is ice. Whinging, you fucking knew I never meant to. Christ. Diaphanous acoustic entry point, clogged and venomous, or worse, tedious, rain followed by snow. Letdowns and come-ons, a baby who can't yet speak, unleashing a caterwaul, instructions, overhaul, I'm sorry, not nearly as often as you'd think, and believe me, more often. To picture them, Watson, the only way we know how, as Lazarus say, pitched up on the other side for the second time, in the coat of his own rot, but human, or the worst of them pinned to their isolate stations, islands in a lake, sheeted white and penancing, then hearing the click, the chink made actual, the beckoning, to see them come running, the boys and girls and men and women, their bare feet flashing, is to err extravagantly. It must be. In the distances between Signal Hill and Rathlin, between the curved horizon of Earth and the ionosphere, they have become pure air, pure interruption, a disturbance like a storm further down the line, undressed by electromagnetism. But wholly literate, they are equivalent to language in its given state. When Louis Blériot flew his biplane from France to England and claimed his £1,000 reward from the Daily Mail, a young Ulster woman was so inspired by powered flight that she wrote Louis Blériot a letter, and she asked him if he would take her up as his passenger. And he wrote back and he said, "Of course not, because you're a woman." And this young woman's response to that rejection was to design, build and fly her own aeroplane, which she did in 1910 in rural Northern Ireland. And she called her plane the Mayfly because she said, "It may fly or it may not fly." She was called Lillian Bland, so she was very inappropriately named. The Mayfly, conspicuously mischristened. What chink in the general atmosphere, what sudden lift of bones and breath allowed you to stand up straight in mechanics' overalls, skirts are out of the question, and plot your escape route into the sky. Like the right foot of Louis Blériot trapped beside one of his overheating engines, like the umpteen previous biplane extravaganzas that had left the ground gadzooks for a couple of minutes, only to wobble uncontrollably in recalcitrant space and then nosedive. Everything flared white hot for you until it abruptly ended. Jiu-jitsu, shooting, horse racing, spending days on remote Scottish islands photographing seabirds. You donned your Donegal cap. The natives, I hear, thought one of the mills had blown up, but put it down to a thunderstorm, and tapped your cigarette ash all over Edwardian decorum. If Blériot wouldn't let you near his channel-hopping aeroplane, you'd begged him in a letter to crown you as his passenger. You'd build and fly your own. The unflexed, held aloft wingspan of gulls in flight was where you started, in the Tobercorren workshop, your gardener's son assistant holding your tools and worshipping you from a distance. I enclose two photos of my biplane, the Mayfly. She is the first biplane to be made in Ireland. Skids of ash, ribs and stanchions of spruce, bamboo outriggers taut beneath unbleached calico, more grasshopper than aircraft. You ran the finished Mayfly, may not fly, still missing its engine and airy as a climbing frame, off the top of Carnmoney Hill, Belfast smouldering under its furnaces, the lock a phlegmatic eye casually watching. And hung as a counterweight, 4 6-foot volunteers from the Irish Constabulary who saw the ground ripped clear of their feet in an upward gust and were trailed alarmingly over heads of astonished livestock before dropping off. In the movie of your life they haven't scripted yet, all bets are on from this moment. It is quite a new sensation being charged by an aeroplane. A horizontally opposed two-cylinder engine with the help of a whiskey bottle and an ear trumpet gets fitted next, and Lord O'Neill of Randallstown Park, so struck by your exploits, offers up his level acreage as a refuge and launching point. The engine is beautifully balanced, but all the same the vibration is enormous. The nuts dance themselves loose. Hooked all your life on barter, a glider for an aeroplane for a motor car, England for Ireland, Ireland for Canada. You knew this was the single most inflammable exchange you'd ever risk. The lone bull standing slack under hawthorn at the edge of the field, quick chatter and flash from the hedgerow, enough of a canopy of willowy light to finally allow admittance, and saw as you climbed up to your tilted seat and got those improbable Victorian pram wheels started, a straggle of farmhands and scullery maids politely assembled, all wishing you skywards. Once it was finished, you ran back over and over to the proof it had happened, the tracks of her passage in the spangled grass, and then their absence, your footprint missing on earth for the span of a furlong, as if a giant had lifted its boot and then set it down. I'll stop there for now. That's 15 minutes, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. That was wonderful. More later. Yes, I wanted to start where people tend to start, by saying, when did you start writing poetry? But also, from what I was reading about you, your poems are highly literary, but they also have very obviously developed spiritual influences. And I read somewhere that R.S. Thomas was a very significant person. So I just wondered if you could tell us more about all that.
Yeah, sure. So I started writing, as a lot of people do, when they're very young. I think I wanted to be a poet from the minute I was exposed to poetry in primary school. So it's always been very clear that that's what I've wanted to do. And then as I read a lot. I read whatever I could find. And as a teenager, I fell very much under the spell of Sylvia Plath, I think, as so many teenage female poets do. Katrina O'Reilly has a fantastic phrase. She says, you know, about being gobbled up by Plath. And I was definitely gobbled up by Plath. And I was writing extremely bad poems as a teenager that were on this very high emotional platform, but it wasn't my emotional platform. It was always an appropriated emotional platform because I was actually quite happy. So there was lots of sort of ethical considerations as well as just very poor aesthetic choices that I was making. And I had a fantastic teacher in school, and everyone was praising my poetry, but she didn't praise it. And she said, I think you're playing around with language before you know what language can actually do. Which was really brilliant, which was a brilliant kind of cautioning voice, and sort of blindsided me for a while. And she said, you have to stop reading Sylvia Plath and start reading R.S. Thomas. she was very directed, you know, she was very directive. She was very clear about what was going to be good advice for me. And I did, and I fell under the spell of that very, very simple syntax that he uses. And the little tight spaces, particularly the later poems, which are all written in solid blocks of text and just are about 13, 14 lines each, little lines, and the vistas that opened up within those deceptively simple spaces,
yes,
and the grappling with huge spiritual questions. In the case of R.S. Thomas, who of course was an Anglican minister, often in a surprisingly negative and apocalyptic way. And I loved that. I loved the magic that happened in those poems because they were speaking about such big things in such simple language and in such small textual spaces.
Yeah.
And so I read him for many years very, very carefully.
Did you? Fascinating. Also, I gather you got obsessed with Edgar Allan Poe, The Raven.
Oh, well, that's way before.
Oh,
yeah,
that's way
yeah.
before.
So that's when I was 10.
Oh, I
yeah,
see.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that happened before.
Yeah. He was one of the, you know, that instigating moments, hearing The Raven, it was like, oh, what's that? That's so magic, I want to be able to do that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, the R.S. Thomas story is so interesting because you were talking to me a lot before we came here about this extraordinary upbringing you had in Northern Ireland and how liberating it was, and
yeah,
how you talked, your family talked about everything, which is very unusual for families, especially in the Troubles, and that you should have chosen a poet who was an Anglican clergyman.
I know.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, we talked about everything, but religion wasn't really a countenance subject, actually, because it was just so straightforwardly wrong and wrong-headed and had, you know, all of that stuff about it being a sop to the working classes so that they don't realise the reality of their situation and have a revolution. So it was an extremely intellectually stimulating household and environment, and it was very politically progressive. And I'm hugely grateful to my parents. Not so much, I mean, in terms of the politically progressive ways in which we're brought up, yes, absolutely, they were absolutely right. I am by no means a communist or an adherent to that socialist political philosophy. But what I really value is that it just gave me a completely alternative perspective on Northern Ireland and on what was happening. And I value the alternative perspective on its own terms, really.
Yes.
And I think that has been a huge influence on the way I write and the way I'm interested in perspective and
yes,
on the malleability of truth, really. Yeah.
I mean, that's what I was next going to ask you. Would you think the fact that they didn't entangle you in the religious stuff, the religious sort of conflicts and things, affected your poetry and the way you wrote it? And
I think what happened, so when I was growing up, I imbued a very ideological and positive sense of the Soviet Union and Russia in particularly, at the height of the Cold War, we were definitely on the side of the Russians. Margaret Thatcher was public enemy number one in our household. Ronald Reagan was public enemy number two.
You can't imagine how refreshing this sounds to an English, well, to me anyway.
And yet a disjunct then opened up, not only in 1989 when the whole thing, which was, you know, so permanent and so correct, when the whole thing disintegrated so quickly and so completely. So how you come to terms with that is one thing, but then I've become very interested in Russian history, and I read a lot of Russian history, particularly Soviet history, and a bigger disjunct opened up in my mind between what I had learned as a child and what I believed as a person under 10, and my reading of what actually happened the whole way through and the ethical questions that gives rise to. And again, I think it's that disjunction that is so creatively fertile. So it's not a content-based influence,
no,
but it is a form-based influence, if you like. And I'm such a formalist, and I'm so fascinated by questions of form. So maybe there's some connection there as well.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. Your poetry is as far as I can see, as much international as it is local. And you've observed foreign cultures like Japan very carefully. You taught in Japan, I think. Can you talk a bit about the effect that Japan had on you? You write about disorientation and about visiting a temple containing stone babies, a graveyard for miscarriages. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, sure. So I went to Japan after I finished my degree at Trinity. I was 23 when I went to Japan, and I'd finished my first collection, which I don't like at all now. I'd sent that off, and that was being published, and then I went to Japan, and I was so euphoric when I went to Japan, because it was so unimaginably different, and I had no connection to that environment. So I had no connection to it either in terms of personal history. I had no connection to it via language. And it was just being severed from your own self, which was so fantastically liberating and exciting, because you could be free to invent whoever you wanted to be, I think. And you had no responsibility for your environment. I didn't know how to write about what I was seeing initially. So Michael Longley had published The Weather in Japan. It was a beautiful, beautiful collection with extremely fine Japanese-like short lyrics, very, lots of white space, relying on the brevity of the utterance. But I couldn't square my own experience and the unexpectedness of my own experience with that style of poetry. So it was so much more industrial than I had imagined in it. And, you know, in my village, there were lots of Brazilian factory workers. I didn't know about that. I didn't know about agricultural high schools, which were wild places. I didn't think that there could be a Japanese school that was as wild as the agricultural high schools were. So I ended up writing a very sort of different kind of poetry, very long-lined, very imagistic, and very euphoric. And I'd met my husband, and I was madly in love. So that all helped, the euphoria. So I think it brought me on in key poetic ways, as well as being really transformative in my life. But, you know, you have to be really careful about assuming an authority to write about another place when you're not from that place, and you actually don't have the authority to do that. So I hope that the poems are more about the perspective and experience of dislocation more than they're attempting to be authoritative about Japan. But that was something that unsettled me at the time. That concern I found quite unsettling. And the second year I lived there, I wasn't able to write at all. So it caused a great sort of flowering and then a complete silence, because I was outside of the water of my own language. And I found it had a dramatically opposite effect after 1 year, and it took me years to get back to language, actually.
Gosh. So you think, because I was going to come to you talk about two silent years, but you think it started because of the Japanese language and the Japanese culture?
Yeah, I think I was so at sea in my second year in all kinds of ways, and I was very ill during my second year. I was ill for a couple of years, beginning in Japan, and I was ill again in New Zealand. But I do think there was something about the profound dislocation, and not being around my own language on an everyday level. And I felt completely cut off from language in a really painful way. I don't think I have a facility with language. I think some poets do, and I think the poets who have a language are blessed beyond measure, because if you have your own language, that's all you need. But I don't have my own language, and I feel that my relationship to language is so fractious and difficult, and it's always a blessing when I feel I'm getting close to a connection.
Is that the same as saying that you used to be more reliant on inspiration? Were you more reliant on inspiration when you before this happened, before the silences?
Yeah, it was more like a listening or a channeling, but
yeah.
I mean, so much more of my creative life has not been like that than ever it was. And when my creative life was like that, I was no good. So I'm really against an idea that you have to be inspired to write.
Yes.
I think it's a false model, and I think that it places the power of creativity outside of yourself and makes you very, very dependent on something that you actually can't control.
So the will and form are the things that you value most. Do you will?
No, I don't know if I will, but and again, the idea is something that is given to you. You know, very much like the muse. Language is never given to me, but an idea might be given to me. I'm so grateful when I have an idea and I think, oh, that could be a poem. So that's, if anywhere, that's where the inspiration is. But I never get given language, ever. And I think form has been the enabler of my mature work. Yeah.
Yes, and it's very striking in this collection how you see form on the what form has done on the page. That's very, very interesting. You certainly had a very varied life, because there was a moment when you worked in prisons. And is that right? You worked inside prisons. And in 2005, you published the collection, The State of the Prisons, where I remember you noticing that you said there was the liberation of going into another person's consciousness and forgetting my eye. It's a wonderful collection. I love it. So can you tell us a bit about your year? Was it a year in prison?
It wasn't anything as substantial as that. But when I was Poet Laureate, I did a whole series of community projects with poetry, and one of them was going into High Bank Women's Prison. And not doing writing workshops, but just poetry reading groups.
Right, right.
And the women were self-selecting, and we'd come together and we'd read poems. And it was the best thing I did as Laureate. It was by far the hardest, the most emotionally draining, and the most rewarding. And I've started work in Franklin Prison in County Durham. I've just moved to Northumberland, moved exactly a year ago. And I've been working in Franklin with a high-security male prison, again with a group of self-selecting prisoners who really want to talk about poetry. And they say they can't get enough of poetry in prison. And it's brilliant. Yeah.
Gosh. Yes, I mean, that collection, you say, is about prisons, sometimes physical, most psychological. And there's a long poem about the prison reformer, John Howard, who you're obviously very interested in, and his own anguish about his failure with his son.
Yeah, well, I invented the anguish. I don't know if he was anguished about his son. I think he probably wasn't, but I came across John Howard, and I'd read a brilliant poem by Elaine Feinstein called Gold. I'd read it in PN Review. And it was a long poem that told the story of Mozart's librettist, who was a Jewish guy who was in Venice. And he wrote the libretto for Marriage of Figaro, and I think the Magic Flute as well. And she'd done this Elaine Feinstein had done this incredible thing. She'd become him, and it was a long poem. She told his story. She told his story of his encounters with Mozart and how quickly they worked together, and the milieu, the 18th century milieu, and the fact that he ended up in the New World running a hardware store. And it was an unlikely and fascinating biography to start with, but she made this beautiful, hammered, golden verse out of that biography. And, you know, a poetic biography is a contradiction in terms. It shouldn't really work. It's too bogged down by fact. It's too bogged down by narrative to really lift and be a poem. But she walked that tightrope so fantastically. So I was inspired to try and do something else. And I'd come across John Howard through my PhD, and I'd come across his book, The State of the Prisons, from 1777. He was the world's first prison reformer. And he went on three epic journeys from Dublin to Constantinople when travelling was very difficult on very poor roads and in terrible conditions. And he went round all the German principalities and talked to the people in charge and told them off about the state of their prisons. Joseph of Austria, he got on well with Joseph of Austria. They thought he was quite like-minded. Hated the Tsarina of Russia and hated the Pope. And so, you know, things slowly changed as a result of his great work, but at the same time he completely neglected his son. His son was left in the care of servants. He never was with his son. And his son, while John Howard's professional life was about a very enlightenment journey from darkness, squalor, to work and light and self-reform and education. That's the vision that he had for prisons, that they would reform people in exactly that way. His son enacted an opposite trajectory. So his son went from a very privileged middle-class life into madness, syphilis, was locked up in an asylum and died young. So I was fascinated by the glaring contradiction between the public trajectory and the private tragedy. And I thought he would be sorry about that, but I have no evidence that he ever was.
And then your collection, Through the Square Window, which was published in 2009, is mainly personal, as far as I could make out. The conception of your child and the birth and early life of your son. It'd be interesting to hear you talk about that part of your life and how it affected your poetry, or if it did.
It did. It was such a profound thing to have children. I wanted to write about it. I didn't want it to be a debarred area, really. So I wanted to write directly out of the experience of becoming a mother. And I was incredibly struck by my first child's process of language acquisition. And I felt incredibly privileged to be beside a human being as they learnt language and to watch how that happened. And so I wrote the book as my son learnt language, I think. Gosh. So it was a sort of mirroring. And I was fascinated by things like, if before you have language, what do you think about? You know, before you have language, what do you dream about? What do you daydream about before you have language? So those kind of things were very fruitful, and I wrote out of that.
You say that on balance, this latest collection was written differently from your other collections. You wanted, I'm reading what you said, you wanted the collection to be very concerned with structures and gravity and deep gravitational forces that hold the world together, and we could tell from your reading of it that that's an extraordinary sense of that going on. Can you explain why it was so different and what made you start writing about that?
Yeah, definitely. So I've always written sort of a group of poems, and then they seem to be coalescing around a theme, and then I would title it quite late on. So the collection before that, Parallax, I just started writing about these old black and white photographs of Belfast around the turn of the century. While the Titanic was being kitted out, photographs of Belfast slum areas. And then I got really interested in photography, so I was writing poem after poem after poem about photographs, and I was really trying to work out the photograph's relationship to truth, which is not a straightforward thing. It's an inherently contradictory thing, and therefore very rich to write out of. But that was, it felt more sort of serendipitous. And I didn't come across the title. I didn't come upon even the meaning or the word parallax until quite late on. And then that seemed to be the thing that held it all together, and it came together right at the end. But this was opposite, so I didn't write anything for a number of years. And then the title came first. So the title just came into my head on balance. I knew that was the title. And a pre-linguistic sense of the book was in my head, and it was about deep structure. I don't even really know what I mean by that, but about architecture and design, and I wanted that to be reflected in the poems I wanted to write about, the things I wanted to write about, such as aeroplanes and acrobats and ships and things that are impossible. But really what I wanted to explore was the tightrope of poetic form. So poetic form itself is a kind of engineering. And that all came before I had any titles or any words. And then a list of titles. I had a whiteboard in my office and I'd get an idea. Like my husband told me to write a poem about Millehelm because he came across the word and he said, do you know what Millehelm means? Write a poem about it. So I had the word Millehelm on my whiteboard, but nothing. And then it's a true story that my great auntie Winnie cleaned the Nottingham Odeon cinema the morning after the Beatles played. And that had just been in family lore, and I thought that's going to be, and I wrote like Beatles poem, and so I had all these titles on a whiteboard for like 2 years, which I didn't write a word of. I didn't know what the words were going to be, and then I had a period off work, and I wrote the whole thing in about 16 weeks.
Wow.
Because I'd been thinking about it, but not writing.
Yes.
Yeah. So I feel really like On Balance was just. It was just given to me. I don't know if another book will ever be given to me in the same way as that book.
What a story. So I'm just going to ask you one more question and then I'll ask you to read again, which is, do you think that poets have a role in life, and do you think they should be engaged politically? And
I think poetry is automatically engaged politically because it's about language. We are the custodians of language in all of its complexity. And that is a political thing. That is an act of revolution. So I don't think you need to write an ostensibly politically engaged poetry, though I think that that is definitely possible and very powerful when it happens. But I think there's something about... the fact that we deal in language at its most beautiful, potentially beautiful, and most intense, and most complicated, that all by itself is a political act.
Well, thank you. Certainly a lot of things about poetry that you explained to me this evening. Thank you very much. Yes. Could you do some more reading?
Yes, sure. So just to go back to Japan briefly, I was married in Japan 23 years ago, and Joseph and I had a Shinto wedding, and we wore all our Shinto clothes in a Shinto temple. We were married in the home of the god of iron. And while I was being dressed with my very heavy headgear and my kimonos, a little dagger was put into my inner waistband, beautiful, encased in a beautiful white lace dagger holder, and it was tucked in. And I said to the woman, "Well, what's the dagger for?" And she said, "Well, if your husband is ever unfaithful, you can commit suicide." So this is written in haiku, and it's 20 years on. I got extremely ill 3 days after our wedding. I had E. coli food poisoning, so I ended up spending what would have been our honeymoon in hospital. And the only other thing to say is, when I say hairs, I mean the animal. Platinum anniversary. The two of us wound into borrowed kimonos on the temple steps. My heavy headgear. Dagger tucked into my waistband should you ever undress another. One flick of my ivory wrist and I'd collapse in the wet of my small intestine. My stomach bridles soon enough over uncooked eggs at the airport, and you, you star, you crucible, my teeth are yours, I think my ribs removable, your unwavering lantern frown above my ice bed, bloody sheets, your trousseau. In my dream, I see our future daughter driving a ragtop, and then I wake or don't, and there's this trick your skin still does if I brush my thumb along it, thronged notes spun into one held hum by a gesture, all the hairs lie down, and the two of us just under half our lives, and this glitch we ride in space together, I see precisely no one else inside this shrinking bubble of light, the minuscule part of matter that's matter splitting apart from itself, bright you singing on the stairway, there's only you. The rope. I have paused in the door jamb shadow to watch you playing shop or cliff or cafe or under the sea among the flotsam of props on our tarmacked driveway. All courtship, all courtesy. At 8 and 6, you have discovered yourselves friends at last, and this the surprise the summer has gifted me, as if some penny-come-handkerchief conjurer had let loose a kingfisher. You whirl and pirouette as in a ballet, take decorous turns and pay for whatever you need with a witch's currency. Grass cuttings, sea glass, coal, an archaeopteryx of glued kindling from the fire basket. You don two invisible outsize overcoats for love, for luck, and jump with your eyes shut. And I can almost see it thicken between you, your sibling tetheredness, an umbilicus, fattened on mornings like this as on a mother's blood, loose, translucent, not yet in focus, but incipient as yeast and already strong enough to knock both of you off your balance when you least expect it, some afternoon after work, decades hence. One call from a far-flung city and, look, all variegated possibles, lovers, kids, apartments, whiten into mist. The rope is flexing, tugging you close, and you come, obedient children that you are, back to this moment, staggering to a halt and then straightening, grown little again inside your oversized coats and shoes and with sea glass still to arrange, but without me watching. And I'm just going to read one more poem. This is a poem for my Belfast grandfather who died in January a couple of years ago, and he was arrested in Belfast when he was a teenager for wearing an Easter lily pin, which he refused to remove. And he was sent to prison for 3 years. He was sent to prison for 3 months. And then the Second World War rolled around and he was interned. There was a widespread policy of internment in Northern Ireland, which not a lot of people know about, even in Northern Ireland. And so he was locked up for the duration of the Second World War. A fact about which he was always very positive. So he would say that that prison had been his university, and he had access to books, he had enough to eat, he didn't have to work, he played chess, he taught himself Irish and bookkeeping, and he read Marx. And so he gave up the cause of Irish republicanism for the cause of international socialism. He became a communist and he worked in the Transport and General Workers Union as their education officer until he was 77. So this is my homage to him. My son is also in it, and my son and I are walking the Belfast hills of West Belfast, Divis and Black Mountain, and we're talking about everything. Thank you so much for your attention on this very, very hot evening in Ledbury. It's lovely to be here. Thank you so much, Chloe, for the invitation to come. The Singing Gates. Up on top of Divis on a freezing Saturday, we pass the Singing Gates. Five barred silver yokes across from the cafe, closed for renovation, penning nothing in but their own frustration. They keen like washerwomen into the billowing sky. You're talking Batman, Two-Face, Robin. You lope ahead and circle and run back, ready to walk for hours if we have time, free at last of school and all the worksheets you never managed to finish on your own. I can no longer ask my granddad exactly how his release was managed back in April 45, 5 years of his young man's life wiped out for being a so-called enemy of the state in wartime, that other bout of internment no one ever mentions. And then what? Tipped out onto the pavement like a sack of damaged apples as the gates of Crumlin Road jail clang shut behind him? My father says he walked to this summit the very next morning, walked to work every day thereafter, walked to think, walked for pleasure, walked to stretch each inch of his cell by laying it down over and over on the floor of the borderless world so that its chipped tile cast iron rectangle could disappear. We opt for the ridge trail, a heathery zigzag that wraps the whole side of the hill in its ribbon, while the joker secedes to mummification and the death rites of ancient Egypt. You're a dark-haired flurry in a hailstorm, running on sugar and bliss, who can't tell B from D because any letter might just flick its Fred Astaire hat and dance backwards across the page if it felt like it. Yet starving all the same for knowledge, imbibing the French Revolution or species of cacti like brawn and remembering everything. My granddad brought his own son here from the age of four on crippling all-day hikes on Saturdays, long before, as the Jesuits saw it, my father had the capacity for resistance to anything and told him brilliant stories. The Battle of Stalingrad, the defence of the Luding Bridge. The great only appear great because we are on our knees. Let us rise. Until the two of them fell asleep in Hatchet Field, clouds passing over their faces like zeppelins. The oil rigs you fell in love with a year ago are still moored at the shipyard's glittering edge. Storms of gunmetal grey touch down precisely in far-off tinker toy villages, though for now we're walking in sunshine, welcome as any downpour after a drought, as you list the typical contents of a sarcophagus and detail the risk of double jeopardy in the hall of two truths. Did you bring joy? Did you find joy? Horace skulking hawk-eyed in the background. For most of my father's childhood, his father must have looked like the man in the black and white photograph I keep sequestered in a notebook. A guest of honour in the Soviet Union, turned Italian in the Black Sea sunshine. His hallmark Donegal suit dramatically cut, skinny like you, and even more electric, a honey magnet, and he knew it, for secretaries, receptionists, stray-passing female fellow revolutionaries, in that dim, hermetic time lock called Transport House, with its tea trolleys, telephone exchanges, ashtrays standing guard along corridors like Russian babushkas in apartment blocks. We can pick out its derelict white, black and turquoise, Belfast's only example of socialist realist architecture, from the rest of the city centre's humdrum colours. Do you want to ask me a question, Mummy? By far your favourite question. as we come up at last by our circuitous route to the granite triangulation point where 3 months earlier my granddad's children and their children and their children took turns with a kitchen scoop to launch what was left of him into the air. He'd made himself so small in the previous months, perhaps out of courtesy. It hadn't been hard. And I want to ask you about the gates we're on our way back to. What wind caught where? In what cavity? Why this particular calibre of sound unravelling only here? Are they in harmony? Are they a choir? Are they, in fact, the singing ticket to the afterlife? And how might we post ourselves into it, limb by limb? What scarab, what amulet, what feather, what scale, what spell?